Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. America's buffalo are beautiful, big, and wild. They're now caught in a battle between the state of Montana and environmentalists. The state has quarantined healthy buffalo in Yellowstone, but now says it's run out of room. It's turned to media mogul Ted Turner, the country's largest buffalo owner, for help. And that help comes with a steep price. This hour On Point, the American West and America's great buffalo kicking up a storm. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the great buffalo at Yellowstone? Does it seem right to move them to private property, to Ted Turner's ranch? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll continue with our commencement series. We'll have John Grisham speaking to the class of 2010 at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Joining me first this hour from Denver, Colorado, is New York Times Denver Bureau Chief Kirk Johnson. He's been following the buffalo story, visited the buffalo on Ted Turner's ranch. Nice to have you, Kirk.
Hi, Jay. Good to be here.
So help us understand exactly what's been happening to American buffalo in Yellowstone National Park.
Well, the first thing to realize is that they are kind of a stranded wild population. When the species was basically almost driven to extinction in the early, late 1800s, this Yellowstone population was kind of marooned there in a place that was already a park. And in the 20th century and the years, decades since, their numbers have grown and they wander. So that has created a continual problem for kind of the ranching country outside the park where they tend to go. In years past, they have been killed in large numbers when they get too many in the park and driven back in the park to sort of contain them there. So they've been a kind of continual political thorn in the side of the sort of ranching and land use issues of the West around the park.
So they wander to the rancher's territory, and what are the problems specifically that ensue?
Well, the bison carry a disease called brucellosis that is a huge problem for cattle if they do catch it from however they get it. The science is becoming increasingly clear that a wild transmission of this disease from bison to cattle is extremely unlikely. So the greater problem that the state is wrestling with and that led them to Ted Turner is, might it be possible to create some transplant wild populations of the Yellowstone bison if we can find a kind of new home for them where they can be in a wild state? And this project with Turner is a kind of a way station to perhaps find that place.
So I'll get into the Ted Turner arrangement in just a minute. But just so I understand, the buffalo that carry this disease, brucellosis,
right.
It kills the cattle. And once the disease hits the cattle flock, every animal in that flock has to be slaughtered. Is that correct?
Right. The rules are very strict in controlling it. If brucellosis gets into a cattle herd, it's the end of the herd. There's definite increasing evidence that elk exposure, who also carry the disease, might be a greater concern for the cattle herds. But that has been sort of the historic driving force of the issue is disease concerns between bison and cattle species.
I see. And so this arrangement was made between the state of Montana and media mogul Ted Turner. And what exactly is that arrangement, that transplant population arrangement that you mentioned?
Turner's ranch near Bozeman has taken 87 bison who were who left the park about 5 years ago or so and have been in kind of a preliminary quarantine state, the arrangement says that he will have them for approximately another 5 years on his ranch. They're on a pretty big expanse of 12,000 acres where they can roam pretty widely. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that time, and this is part of what has created quite a bit of controversy, the Turner Enterprises will be allowed to keep 75% of the offspring born to that herd during the time of their sojourn on the ranch.
So Ted Turner keeps 75% of the buffalo calves, 25% then what, go back to the state?
Correct. At the end of the 5 years or whenever, if the state finds a new home sooner, the original animals and 25% of the offspring born during that time go back to the state, and Turner keeps the 75%. And under the application agreement documents that Turner Enterprises filed with the state, their intention is to interbreed these animals with an existing herd that they have down in New Mexico, but they're not really bound by any specific anything at all. Once they own the animals, they can do with them as they wish as a company.
You visited Ted Turner's ranch. I'm curious, what was your impression?
Well, it's an incredibly beautiful setting for sure. It's about 20 miles west of Bozeman. Huge ranch. Was a combined ranch, different ranches that were combined under Turner, and the bison from Yellowstone have been segregated from Turner's regular commercial bison herds. He's the largest commercial bison rancher in the country by far, and those are on a different part of the ranch. The 87 from Yellowstone are kind of sequestered in a huge space where they look, for all that I can tell, to be living the natural life out there. The bulls and the cows and the calves are all together in a kind of a natural herd, and the state's hope is that, you know, this group kind of emerges from there to be a population that can live in some fashion of a wild state, wherever they can find a home.
Well, Kirk Johnson, thank you. By the way, are the terms bison and buffalo interchangeable?
Yeah, I mean, the bison is the sort of formal and scientific name, but when Europeans came, you know, the animals look like, you know, water buffalo or the other creatures, and they kind of got called buffalo, but they're interchangeable, yes.
Well, thank you very much for your perspective. Kirk Johnson is the Denver Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He spoke with me from Denver. Thanks, Kirk.
Thank you.
Joining me now from DePuyer, Montana, is David Risley, Montana's Fish and Wildlife Administrator. He helped coordinate the deal that moved more than 80 buffalo from Yellowstone to Ted Turner's ranch. Nice to have you, Mr. Risley.
Thank you, Jane.
Why is it so important to quarantine the buffalo from the state's perspective?
Well, this was really a feasibility study. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, that it was a research project. And as we look at repatriating bison in some fashion on the landscape, whether that's a behind a fence or free roaming, truly free roaming, one of the big concerns of the agricultural livestock community is the disease issue.
Mm-hmm.
And brucellosis is the disease, and it has a unknown latency period. And so what we wanted to do as part of this project is do bison truly remain brucellosis free over a long period of time? And so far we've had these 87 bison have remained brucellosis free over a 4 to 5 year period.
Mm-hmm. There are inoculations or vaccines against brucellosis. Are they being considered, and have they been during this process?
We haven't considered them. One of the problems with the vaccine is the efficacy rate. They are only, I've heard 40 to 55% effective. And so, that's a little bit better than, or about like flipping a coin as far as whether the vaccine is going to work or not.
The biggest point of contention, as we just heard from Kirk Johnson, is the fact that Ted Turner, after these buffalo are moved to his land, after 5 years, will keep 75% of the calves that are born on his property. 25% will go back to the state. Was that a crucial part of this deal? I mean, how did those numbers come about?
It was part of a request for proposal process that we did. And it was a fairly long process. It started last summer. And we had, when we got into this project years ago, we had several options on the table. We thought we were going to be able to take care of the bison. And all of those options basically disappeared over the last several years. And so we were stuck with 87 bison and running out of room. So we went through the request for proposal, and all of the first proposals that we got back the first time had some type of retention of the bison, of the offspring. And so since that wasn't in our original proposal, we went in and reissued the request for proposal, and I made that one of the acceptable options.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the deal that sent Yellowstone buffalo to Ted Turner's private ranch. David Risley is from Montana's Fish and Wildlife Administration. He's with us. He helped coordinate the deal that moved more than 80 buffalo from Yellowstone to Ted Turner's ranch. David, let me read you a couple of comments from our listeners. This is from our Facebook page. Desiree Gutierrez says, I think this is fine. Buffalo are almost as thick as the RV traffic at Yellowstone. Perhaps he can take some of those as well. Here's Gustavo Pena, who says, I was a guest at the Turner Ranch once upon a time, and the Turner family are great stewards of the land, very caring of the Montana-Wyoming ecosystem. The move is temporary, and to Buffalo, it's just a roam. David Risley, this is a deal that runs for 5 years between the state of Montana and Ted Turner. What happens to the buffalo in 5 years? Is there any chance the buffalo will stay on Ted Turner's ranch?
I would think not. I would think that we should be able to figure this out in a five-year period. Actually, our target is about a year and a half. What we would like to do is figure out what the role of bison are in the landscape of Montana. Now, are they truly going to be free roaming someplace where they won't cause conflict with human endeavors, or are they going to stay on Yellowstone and under our current management scheme?
Are there restraints for Ted Turner? May he use the buffalo for commercial breeding or for selling, perhaps?
At the end of the agreement period, he will be able to take his 75% and use them for whatever purpose he deems appropriate.
Let's get a call here from Michael in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hi, Michael. Welcome to On Point.
Yeah, hi. I'm originally from Santa Fe, New Mexico, mm-hmm. and we went through the same problem with Ted Turner buying up all the land in New Mexico, much to the dismay of the New Mexicans. But he has more money than God. But what I'm saying is that he's raising buffalo on his own land for tax purposes. It's not through any kind of saving the animal. And he gets no land tax because he raises what they call an endangered species. Now, what is this? What kind of nonsense is this? Who can get away with it except Ted Turner? And I need some answers. Thank you.
Michael, thank you. David Risley.
I think that the caller kind of changed the focus a little bit to Ted Turner as opposed to the project itself. And and he does draw a lot of criticism because of his land holdings. But I think the private-public partnership is critical to the future of wildlife, not necessarily bison. But when we take a look at a lot of our access issues, we rely on private landowners for quite a bit of our habitat and a lot of our access.
What about the tax-free implications for Ted Turner, as the caller referred to?
I have no idea what he's talking about.
Can you describe a couple of the other most feasible options that you pursued beyond Ted Turner to find a home for the Yellowstone buffalo?
One of the options was one of our Native American reservations. And actually, that looked like a fairly good option. But the particular tribe that we had been negotiating with, the tribal council, declined the offer. They said they did not want them. Even those options did have some drawbacks because they basically would privatize the animals. They would sell them, and they would sell hunts of the offspring. So, I mean, nothing was as pure and clean, I think, as some of our detractors would have liked.
Do you see this solution, David Risley, from Montana's Fish and Wildlife Administration, do you see this solution as a one-time deal, or do you foresee it becoming increasingly necessary to do more public-private deals as this one?
I think this particular type of project is a one-time deal. I think what Turner Enterprises is doing is buying us time. I do see more and more public and private partnerships, but not in this form.
Let's get another voice into this conversation now, David Risley. Hold on for a moment. Let's go to Missoula, Montana. Summer Nelson is there. She's Montana legal counsel at the Western Watersheds Project, which has filed lawsuit on behalf of itself and three other environmental groups against the state of Montana for transferring buffalo to Ted Turner's ranch. Summer Nelson, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So how do you see the role of the state in protecting the Yellowstone buffalo?
Well, the state has the responsibility to protect these wildlife as part of a public trust. They're a public resource that's commonly held for the benefit of all the public. And here the state has to take the initiative of finding an appropriate home and protecting that public trust interest. And if the proposals that they received related to their study are inadequate, it's their responsibility not to accept those, but to create another alternative that would be an appropriate home for these bison.
Do you have another feasible option that you think the state did not consider that it should have?
Well, part of the problem was the state really didn't consider any other alternatives seriously. In its environmental assessment, it pretty much dismissed all other alternatives and didn't propose any itself. Instead, it relied on other parties to make proposals, when really it's the state's responsibility not only to finish its own study appropriately, but to protect these bison. And actually, a number of members of the public, including the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, did suggest a number of alternatives to the state that they declined to consider.
And why do you think they declined to consider?
It's unclear, but it appears that really, because there's a lot of controversy surrounding bison, it's challenging to find a place that the livestock industry will accept having these wild bison. The public is demanding these wild bison. The public wants bison on public lands. The private landowners around West Yellowstone have said over and over again they want bison on their private lands as well. But the state has just been really reluctant to take the political initiative and make sure that the public gets wild bison protected on our state-owned lands.
David Risley, would you respond to that?
Sure. Well, one of the problems that I think that Summer referred to was release of the bison on public lands. And there are a lot of public lands in Montana. Unfortunately, I think as someone mentioned to me the other day, buffalo do roam. And once they do start to move off of public land onto private land, you get into the 200-year-old war for grass and destruction that bison can cause, and fencing and And then the disease issue was just, you know, one other issue that we hopefully were trying to solve with that feasibility study.
Summer Nelson, what about the disease issue? I mean, has the state gone too far in protecting these cattle from brucellosis, this disease that, the bison carry, given that disease is mostly spread during reproduction and the cattle and the bison don't reproduce with each other? So do you feel it's really necessary to quarantine the animals for so long on private land?
Absolutely not. The quarantine itself is really unnecessary. As I think Kirk Johnson mentioned, scientists have pointed out that the risk of transmission between wild bison and domestic cattle is extremely low. And one report actually indicated that in most years, the risk would be zero. There are a lot of other ways to manage that risk without quarantining the bison, without slaughtering the bison, without hazing them right after they've given birth several miles back into Yellowstone National Park every year. In fact, domestic cattle and bison have co-mingled south of Yellowstone Park in Wyoming for a number of years without a single incident of transmission from those wild bison to cattle. All of the incidences of brucellosis that have occurred recently in domestic cattle herds have not been due to bison at all. They're most likely from elk or other cattle that have been imported into those states. So bison have not been shown to pose any real risk. So all of these measures that the state and federal agencies have been taking are really unnecessary and are likely causing damage to these bison populations, their genetic integrity, and the way that they function in the ecosystem.
David Risley, that doesn't sound so good. I'll give you time to respond.
Well, I think Summer makes a very good point. I mean, it is a disease management issue, and it's a lot more complicated than just bison, because bison and elk also carry brucellosis. And so, you know, cause and effect is a little bit difficult to pin down, and we're dealing with three states and their respective wildlife agencies and livestock industry, and a 2-million-acre national park. And, you know, so the disease management issue, I agree, is not going to be solved by the bison quarantine. What is going to be solved by our quarantine study is to be able to see if we truly can get brucellosis-free bison for moving other places.
Well, David Risley, I know you have to be on your way, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you. It was nice talking with you.
Nice speaking with you. David Risley is Montana's Fish and Wildlife Administrator. Let's go to the phones. Dine is calling from Blackfoot, Idaho. Hi, Dine. Welcome to the program.
Greetings.
Hello. Go ahead.
Yes. I'm listening to the callers as much as I can, and I kind of find it ironic that the most of the comments are about personalities rather than about the animals. The animals themselves, and as far as I've been able to ascertain, are being well cared for. They're observable. They're in about as natural of an environment as you could come up with. Yet the process seems to be about personalities, whether it's their bias against Ted Turner or a bias against any private entity. I think for him to get 75% of the offspring, which is, if there's 100 head and they have 25 cows or, you know, calves, then he's going to get, what, 15 animals. I don't see that as outrageous. I think he's doing us a favor, and I believe that the misdirected vitriol really should be looked at.
Dine, thank you very much. Summer Nelson, what about it? Do you worry about how the bison might be treated on Ted Turner's private land? I mean, do you feel that his ranch somehow will not meet their needs?
You know, Jane, the caller makes an important point that this really is not about the personalities, and it's not about Ted Turner or Turner Enterprises. Really, the concern is that this decision that the state made results in privatizing wildlife. It's not a public-private partnership that's carefully designed for restoration or conservation. It's taking public wildlife that were removed from the nation's first national park and turning them into privately owned livestock. They're taking wildlife and turning them into chattel.
Let me get another voice into this conversation now. Let's go to Calgary, Canada. Cormac Gates is professor of environmental design at the University of Calgary. He's the lead editor and author of several chapters of the 2010 International Union for Conservation of Nature publication, American Buffalo Status Survey and Conservation Guidelines. Cormac Gates, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Tell me how you see this and respond directly to what Summer Nelson just said about the privatizing of wildlife.
Well, I agree with that point. I think that there's some enormous issues around privatization of wildlife where they're being used for what I've referred to as captive commercial propagation. I don't rule it out entirely, but we're not really achieving, if you like, conservation of bison in the long term through privatization. And I think the major challenge is, with respect to bison, is to create new opportunities for these animals on this continent to be wild bison, a very challenging proposition for plains bison, because the original range of the plains bison is now used predominantly for other purposes. And so the places where we can achieve significant conservation herds are extremely limited.
So to that point, then, has the state of Montana done the right thing by moving the Yellowstone bison, buffalo, to Ted Turner's ranch, to private land?
Well, I'm not directly familiar with the issue. I haven't been involved in it, and so I'm somewhat of an outsider in that regard. But what I have learned about it is that this is a temporary situation, and I understand that the state has its eye on, if you like, the longer term, or maintaining the opportunity in the longer term for moving animals into a wild situation. And I think that that vision, if you like, is quite laudable from a conservation standpoint. And I do hope that it can be achieved sooner rather than later. The comment that I would have with regard to that is that the Yellowstone National Park herd is an extremely valuable gene pool for a number of reasons. First of all, it represents the last, if you like, wild bison genetically that were plains bison that were on the continent, and there are very few of them that actually survived in the park back in the early part of the last century, and they were augmented by animals brought in from elsewhere. As far as we know, they're cattle gene free, which is an important component, and so creating situations throughout the original range of the plains bison where Yellowstone animals can be drawn upon and moved out to create new populations, I think, is an extremely important goal.
Do the demands, the modern demands of agriculture and ranching and development make this issue more complicated to your mind?
Well, this is extremely complicated. I think a real challenge for, if you like, the conservation development arena. And I would like to encourage folks to really focus their energies on where those opportunities might rest, both in the United States and Canada, as to where we can start new populations, drawing upon the Yellowstone gene pool, moving them through a disease eradication type program that conserves the genetic integrity of that gene pool. So I'll just give you an example of a recent reintroduction that occurred. It was in northern Mexico just last November, where the Nature Conservancy brought animals from Wind Cave National Park, originally Yellowstone gene pool, and reestablished them in the Llanos Valley grasslands, an area that was declared as a biosphere reserve by the president of Mexico last December. That's an example of what can be done if the will can be created amongst the local population, landowners, with a vision from government as well, supported by non-government organizations. I'd really like to encourage that type of action to occur as well in America.
The This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Great American Buffalo and the American West now. We're speaking with Summer Nelson, Montana Legal Counsel at the Western Watersheds Project, which has filed a lawsuit on behalf of itself and three other environmental groups against the state of Montana for transferring buffalo to Ted Turner's ranch. And also with Cormac Gates, professor of environmental design at the University of Calgary. He's the lead editor and author of several chapters of the 2010 International Union for Conservation of Nature publication, American Buffalo Status Survey and Conservation Guidelines. Summer Nelson, tell me about this lawsuit by this coalition of environmentalists. What exactly do you want?
Well, we're asking that the state fully consider all alternatives, consider the impacts to the public trust and its public trust responsibilities of its decision, and go back and make a decision that ensures that the bison are protected as a public trust resource. Basically, the public trust doctrine was the original legal mechanism to ensure that governments safeguard natural resources that are necessary for public welfare and survival. Wildlife are part of that public trust, and the state has to protect and manage them for public benefit rather than alienate them to private parties for their own private uses.
You talk of public trust. What about public access? Will this deal between Montana and Ted Turner to move buffalo to his private land, will it hamper the public's ability to interact with the bison? Is that of concern to you?
Absolutely. We've already seen evidence of that. One of the plaintiffs, Buffalo Field Campaign, actually learned that one of the bison that was reportedly moved to Turner's ranch actually died when it was there, but it took weeks for the public to get that information. You know, another member of one of the plaintiff organizations, the Gallatin Wildlife Association, went out and tried to locate the bison on the ranch and could not determine which ones were actually the bison that were taken out of Yellowstone National Park. And both of those things emphasize the lack of public access, the lack of accountability to the public while these bison are out of the public domain. We're also concerned about the precedent that this sets. There's no guarantee that even those bison that are set to be returned to the state will be managed as wildlife, that they'll be on public or tribal lands. And really, there are no guarantees that this precedent won't continue to apply to other bison or any other wildlife.
Well, let me ask you about that, because the state of Montana has actually moved bison before. They've auctioned off bison in the past. We spoke to Chris Sullivan. He's president of the Montana Bison Association, who's bought many bison from the state. He's told us the auctions happen roughly once a year. So why do you think this particular case is causing so much outrage?
I think the concern is that these particular bison are really valuable and unique. You know, they're the last wild herd. They're descended from the only continuously wild population of bison that still remained after they were nearly exterminated. They're shown to have unique genetic characteristics. There are multiple distinct populations, and that is of management concern. And they interact on the landscape in a unique way because they're an isolated population. And to take these bison and instead of ensuring that they're restored on the land and protected for the cultural and ecological value that they have, turned into privately owned livestock is unprecedented. And even if the state can find, you know, other examples where there are blurred lines between private and public wildlife, it's becoming more and more important that we draw clear lines that protect wildlife and prevent privatization. The trend is away from privatization, and this goes against that trend and sets a bad precedent for future actions.
Let's bring another voice in here. Chris is on the line from Dixon, Montana. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Jane. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
What I'd like to comment on is that some of the information is erroneous as far as federal animals not being on private land.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a small bison ranch in Montana, and I've had federal animals on my place for approximately 8 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They originated as federal animals, but each year, for many years, the National Bison Range has had a auction, and the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has sold to private individuals many animals over the years.
And what's been the outcome of that? Has it been positive?
I think it's been very positive. Bison were whittled down to 300 animals at one time. The estimate is that in 1907 there were only 50 animals in Yellowstone, 50 bison in Yellowstone. And so the genetics are such that from 50 animals, at one time the Yellowstone population boomed to 5,000 animals from 50 animals. The genetics is what's really important, and it's not only important for Yellowstone, but for all the people involved in bison.
Chris, thank you very much. Cormac Gates, jump in here. I mean, there's a bison rancher in Montana who says this has happened before, and it's actually increased the populations. This is good for the animals. What do you say?
Well, I think there are several issues here. First of all, I agree with the caller that that more bison is better. Drawing upon the gene pools that are intact and that have been honed, if you like, by natural selection, Mother Nature, wolves, and severe climate effects and whatnot, that represents a robust gene pool. I think there are some issues, however, with regard to those types of natural selection herds being exposed to all of the elements of Mother Nature versus captive commercial propagation, where even if owners want to manage bison as bison, they're subject to some constraints. Some operators manage bison for the marketplace. This is both as livestock for meat or carcass characteristics, breeding stock, this sort of thing. That's what the marketplace is all about.
Mm-hmm.
Other owners do their best to maintain bison as bison, but are limited, mm-hmm. I guess, in that regard, in terms of what they can do. The amount of land they have, the type of fencing they have,
right.
The herd structure.
Right.
So I think there's some real issues with the captive commercial industry. Not that I think there isn't a role for private owners. It's just that I would like to encourage governments play a very significant role in finding those special places, large landscapes where bison can truly be managed as wildlife, as public trust wildlife.
Summer Nelson, how do you respond to the caller, Chris, the bison rancher in Montana, who says this works?
Well, I agree with a lot of what Cormac just said, that there are a number of concerns, you know, and I think it's clear that there's a real value for wild, publicly held wildlife. If we're talking about restoring wildlife on a landscape level, if all of those are isolated in privately owned and heavily managed populations, it's not going to accomplish our goals of ecosystem restoration and wildlife restoration. And traditionally, wildlife have been considered a public resource and are valuable for the way they interact on the landscape. And I do also think it's important to point out that the organizations that are involved in this lawsuit are not saying there's no role for private landowners to participate in well-planned-out restoration efforts. That's not what is happening here, however. It was kind of a last-minute changing the state's criteria for their proposals because they found themselves without a plan for these bison. And they made a decision that results in privatizing a full 75% of the offspring that will be born over the next 5 years. If they had done their job and used the 4 or 5 years that they had leading up to this point, they could have planned appropriately and found a location for these bison that would have ensured that all of them remain in the public trust rather than bartering away some of those offspring that are highly valuable.
Cormac Gates, are there new places for the buffalo to go? And the question I asked David Risley earlier, I'll ask you. Do you see this as a solution that's a one-time deal, or will it become increasingly necessary to have more of these public-private deals?
Well, I guess really those are two questions. First of all, they're finding places on the continent where you can have substantial populations of bison interacting in large landscapes with other wildlife species and with the flora of an area. Those are very difficult places to seam together. Typically, they will involve a combination of public and private lands. And so I think there may be some opportunities there for, if you like, public-private partnerships. I point to the Nature Conservancy just as an example of a private organization that is in the business of acquiring lands through purchases and easements and is using it for purposes of nature conservation involving bison. I believe there are about 9 herds that they manage. There may be a role for producers as well in the livestock industry to play such a role, but I haven't seen an example yet of a public-private partnership around ecosystem conservation involving bison. I think mm-hmm. that might be a novel and very fruitful policy arena to think about. I'm unaware of an example yet where details have been worked out to do that sort of thing.
Summer Nelson, I'll give you the last word in the 30 seconds we have left.
I think that there are plenty of opportunities if we just make a little bit of room for these bison to restore themselves. There's a lot of habitat, both private and public land, surrounding Yellowstone National Park, as well as wildlife management areas. And as soon as we make room for these bison, they will restore themselves and in turn restore the landscape that they're part of.
Well, this is an interesting and really important issue. Thank you very much to both of you for being here today. Summer Nelson, Montana Legal Counsel at the Western Watersheds Project. I appreciate your time, Summer. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.
And Cormac Gates from Calgary, Canada, Professor of Environmental Design at the University of Calgary. Cormac, thank you.
You're very welcome.
In a moment, John Grisham speaks to 2010 graduates at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This commencement season, we are airing excerpts from notable addresses from around the country. International best-selling author John Grisham has written 23 books with more than 250 million copies sold worldwide. He's a lawyer-turned-author and is best known for his modern legal thrillers such as A Time to Kill, The Fern, The Pelican Brief, and The Broker. On Sunday, May 9th, John Grisham spoke to graduates of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
The most difficult part of writing a book is not devising a plot which will captivate the reader. It is not developing characters the reader will have strong feelings for or against. It is not finding a setting which will take the reader to a place he or she has never been. It is not the research, whether in fiction or in nonfiction. The most difficult task facing a writer is to find a voice in which to tell the story. A voice is pronunciation, diction, syntax, dialogue, plot, character, the ABCs of writing. But a writer's voice is much more. A writer's voice is the tone, the mood, the point of view, the consciousness, the sense of credibility. I have never thought of writing as hard work, but I have worked hard to find a voice. All writers do. Sometimes we are successful, often we are not. But long before the last chapter is finished, and often before the first chapter is started, we search and search to find a voice. Students of creative writing are constantly urged, find a voice in which to tell the story. And to do this, they are taught to try different techniques, different narrations, different points of view, all in an effort to find the voice. When a writer finds the voice, the words flow freely, the sentences become paragraphs and pages and chapters, and the story is told. The writer is heard, and the reader is rewarded. In this respect, writing is a lot like life itself. In life, a voice is much more than the sound we make when we talk. Infants and preschoolers have voices and can make a lot of noise. But a voice is more than sound. The voice of change, the voice of compassion, the voice of the future, the voice of his generation, the voice of her people. We hear this all the time. Voices, not words. There are over 5,600 of you in the class of 2010, and I doubt seriously right now if any one of you believes that you will leave here today, go out into the world, start your career, and not be heard. Isn't that one of our greatest fears? We will not be heard. No one will listen to us. When we are ready to lead, there's no one to follow. But to be heard, you must find a voice. For your ideas to be accepted, for your arguments to be believed, for your work to be admired, you must find a voice.
That's author John Grisham speaking to graduates at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, on May 9th. For more commencement addresses that have aired on the program and for a video and transcript of John Grisham's speech, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.